if you're floating at 150 or 200 over LIBOR, which a lot of the floaters were on the 06 and 07 vintage loans, you're not even paying 2% for your debt. And so you can have positive cash flow, but still have very, very significant negative equity positions.
Welcome to the Alter Group Podcasts on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is Bob Nackel, chairman and founding partner of Massey Nackel Realty Services, a full-service property sales firm. A graduate from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, he has closed over 3,500 transactions with a market value in excess of $11 billion. Previously author of the nationally syndicated real estate blog Streetwise, he now writes for New York's Commercial Observer. Bob, I want to open by asking you about the real estate investment market. There was more capital coming into the market this year. We saw the REITs issue about $37.5 billion in new shares, up 32% from 2010. Even CMBS had between $40 and $60 billion in new issuances. Any sense of why it is there's so much interest and influx of capital into the real estate industry at a time of historic recession?
I think there's a growing percentage of economists that believe that we are likely to have a double dip. And what all this uncertainty has done is that it's created a tremendous appetite amongst investors for hard assets. If you look at what's happened in the U.S., we've had a nearly tripling of the money supply since 2009. And if a QE3 is announced, which there are some people who think that it will be shortly, that will exacerbate that problem. We've had the Federal Reserve more than double its balance sheet in the past 2 years. And these things are clearly creating inflationary pressures in the market. And I think that because of the Fed's highly accommodative monetary policy, you have seen a tremendous buildup in these inflationary pressures. And while we haven't experienced them yet, I think that most people believe we will have very significant inflation in the not-too-distant future. And if that's the case, you want to own hard assets, which is why we see gold rallying. It's also why the record amount of cash is being targeted towards commercial real estate. And so I think if you look across the board, you've seen institutional capital increase their allocations for commercial real estate, sovereign wealth funds, high net worth individuals, family investors. We've seen tremendous capital look for hard assets, and real estate is one of the best hard assets to own.
Bob, the investment sales market is on fire right now. I mean, look at some of these numbers. Up 253% in Phoenix, up 204% in Atlanta, up 267% in Pittsburgh. Give us a sense of how much we should take from these numbers.
On the investment sales side, I think it's very important to differentiate between dollar volume of sales, which I'm sure are what your statistics you just quoted are based on, versus the number of transactions being done. And we've seen the same dynamics here in the New York City market, where we had effectively a doubling of investment sales from 09 to 10. We went from $6.2 billion in 2009 to $14.5 billion in 2010. We're on pace for about $27 billion this year. But that's on a dollar volume basis. But if you look at the number of properties sold, we were only up 16% in 2010 from 2009 and only on pace to be up about 20% in 2011 versus 2010. So what we're seeing is clearly a trend towards larger transactions with bigger financings, which have been available to create those larger transactions. We've seen here in New York, and I think this is symptomatic of dynamics across the country, we've seen large property owners decide, hey, things are a heck of a lot better than they were in 2009. Let's take advantage of the market and take some chips off the table. And so we've seen a lot more larger transactions across the country occurring now than happened in 2010 or certainly 2009. And that's what really is fueling the big increase in the dollar volume of sales.
Bob, I want to turn to the issue of debt. There's about $1.5 trillion right now outstanding that's going to roll over in the next 3 years. About $450 billion will be needed just to bail out the troubled slices of those loans. Are we going to see more pretend and extend, or do you think we'll see investors acquiring debt and default at, you know, 50 cents on the dollar and ending up with the real estate?
Well, I think that is creating something that we refer to as shadow distress. You know, if you look at the trends of distressed asset sales, we went through a period where banks became very aggressive in terms of trying to rid balance sheets of bad assets. In 2010, you know, we saw at the very beginning of the year banks become aggressive. They were selling a lot of notes. The recovery on note sales was very good relative to collateral value, although it may have been well below what par value was. Towards the second half of the year, we saw the special servicers start to get involved and became aggressive on the note sale front particularly. But I think that if you look at distressed asset sales, we saw in 2010 probably 75% of those note sales were effectuated by banks and 25% by special servicers. We think this year those percentages will be inverted, and probably 75% of the activity in that space will be implemented by special servicers, and banks will be about 25%. And it seems like the pace of foreclosures is slowing. Delinquency pace seems to be slowing. But we have to put that in perspective, because we are operating in such an extraordinarily low interest rate environment that will tend to keep things floating along. And I think if you look at a number of the loans that were made in 2006 and 2007 that are the most distressed, some of these properties that serve as the collateral for those loans may have positive cash flow today, because the interest rates are floating over LIBOR, which is minuscule. I think LIBOR opened at 21 basis points this morning. If you're floating at 150 or 200 over LIBOR, which a lot of the floaters were on the 06 and 07 vintage loans, you're not even paying 2% for your debt. And so you can have positive cash flow, but still have very, very significant negative equity positions. And so we call that shadow distress, because from the borrower's perspective, they have positive cash flow. They're sitting back and just hoping that somehow they miraculously get bailed out. And the lender has a performing loan, so they kind of don't want to acknowledge that there's a problem out there. But when those loans mature, and that is the initially what you had asked, mortgage maturity is going to create a lot of action that has to be taken by the market, because there is no way a lender is going to extend a loan at 2%. That doesn't make any sense today.
Bob, is there a sense that because of the Fed's interest rate policy and T-bills being essentially locked at a very, very low yield, that institutional capital is now out in the market chasing distressed assets?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The opportunity funds and the distressed asset buying funds really were a function of the fact that the institutional capital that inflated the asset bubble in the 05 to 07 period essentially had nothing to do for a couple of years. And they've reinvented themselves. They've come back with these opportunity funds or distressed asset funds looking specifically to buy distressed debt. And because of that, the demand for distressed debt is excessive today. And we've seen notes sell at very, very high percentages of collateral value. And in some cases, almost 100% of collateral value, which doesn't appear to make any intuitive sense, because you still have to go through the foreclosure process. But, you know, Tom, when you mentioned 50 cents on the dollar, there's a question of whether you are comparing the amount paid for that distressed debt to the value of the collateral or the par value of the loan. And in a lot of cases, an investor can be paying 90 or 95 or 100% of collateral value for the paper, but that still could be a 20, 30, 40% discount to par value.
Bob, we've been talking largely about banks. So they hold $794 billion in mortgages, but almost as important as the CMBS market, particularly on the refinancing side, $626 billion in mortgages. Delinquencies have been coming down about 236 basis points, mostly because of write-downs. Give us a sense of where you think the CMBS market is going.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, CMBS was a $230 billion industry in 2007 that was essentially dormant for 18 months during the credit crisis, and it started to come back fairly nicely. While it was referred to as CMBS 2.0, it was not different in any way whatsoever than CMBS 1.0, which was very interesting. But we've seen a resurgence to some degree of CMBS. There have been a couple of transactions that banks have tried to bring to market that were unsuccessful, creating a little bit of uncertainty. And I think that the downgrading of the U.S.'s credit rating by S&P has served a dual purpose, or has had a dual impact on the financing markets in the U.S. One is that for portfolio lenders who are typically lending at spreads above treasuries, the fact that the Fed has come out and said that rates are going to stay relatively unchanged until mid-2013, that has seen a positive impact on lending rates because interest rates are so low. And the uncertainty that's been created worldwide has created a flight to quality, and notwithstanding the downgrading of the stock, we've seen a flood of capital into the treasury market such that the 10-year is floating just a few basis points over 2% now, which is really remarkable. So from a portfolio lender's perspective, it's a very, very positive dynamic. However, the uncertainty created in the capital markets has made the CMBS market a little more tenuous. I think that the difficulty that that has been created and the volatility of the stock market has probably created a little bit more uncertainty for the CMBS market, and it wouldn't be surprising to see issuance slow down a little bit because of that.
Bob, what's happening on in the equity markets with REIT stocks, as an example? There are some who think that notwithstanding the 635-point dip in the stock market when the credit downgrade happened, that there's been a real bubble in the stock market and that REIT stocks have been the beneficiary of that. Do you see this continuing, or do you think there'll be a correction?
A low interest rate environment for an extended period of time is very indicative of failed monetary and fiscal policy. And given that, and given the uncertainty that's inherent in the market, it's not not far-fetched to think that there may be a bubble in the stock market, actually. When you have such cheap money and corporate profits being as high as they have been, you know, it's not surprising to see volatility in equities. And I think that, you know, to the extent you have a situation where that market could be negatively impacted, that could affect REITs. Now, that being said, REITs have raised such a tremendous amount of capital that I think they're very well positioned to take advantage of current market dynamics. I don't think that, given the underlying value of REIT stocks are hard assets, I think they are in a better position to weather the storm than a typical company. But it will be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, over the past couple of weeks, we've seen dramatic equity sell-offs, not only in the U.S., but across the globe. If you look at the DAX, the Nikkei, or the CAC 40, we've seen in every major market, we've seen multiple percentage point losses on a number of occasions. And that is based on the total uncertainty that exists relative to where we're headed.
Bob, I want to end with some macroeconomic questions. Firstly, corporate profits off the charts right now. Corporations sitting at about $1.8 trillion in cash at a time when there's no private sector job growth. Give us a sense of what we're to make of that.
Well, what you make of it is that companies are not hiring, not because they are unable to, but because they are choosing not to. And that is based on the uncertainty that exists, the financial uncertainty globally, uncertainty relative to what costs are going to be moving forward. We've had two major legislative changes that Americans have to deal with. One is the new healthcare system. When that really kicks in, I don't think there's a single person in the country that truly believes that healthcare costs are going to go down when you're going to be providing insurance to 35 million more people than had it before. Clearly, costs are going to go up. I know at our firm, healthcare costs are up 24% this year over last year. And I think that even the giant corporations are seeing well into the high teens in terms of annual healthcare cost increases. So that's a big concern. Dodd-Frank is another thing that causes a tremendous pause for companies. You know, when Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted, I think there were 16 new regulations that were part of Sarbanes-Oxley, and it took corporate America years to become comfortable with that regulation. The new Dodd-Frank bill has over 200 of those, and I've heard several instances of companies that actually had to let go of productive workers because they have to hire compliance officers to figure out what they had to do to comply with Dodd-Frank. So I think if you look at things from a company's perspective, yes, they've made tremendous profits, but think about it. If we're employing 25 million less people today than were being employed 3 years ago, that's a lot of cost savings, and that translates into a lot of profits. But layer on top of that the fact that there is tremendous uncertainty moving forward, and clearly you have an administration that has demonstrated an anti-business perspective and constantly raises the specter of increased taxes. You can't blame a company for being relatively conservative, and particularly if you don't see end-user demand for the products or services that you are going to be creating. You know, there's good reason for companies not to be overly aggressive and expand the way they might otherwise.
Bob, final thoughts about where you think we stand as we move into this new year?
We really have a long way to go. I think that what has happened over the last 2 or 3 years is we've simply had a shift of private sector leverage being converted to public sector leverage. There's still far too much leverage in the system. And, you know, we need a way to figure out how to deal with the issues that we have, which is going to take a tremendous amount of political will from people. And this is not just a U.S. problem. This is a global problem where promises have been made to people that can't possibly be kept. And when you have unsustainability as the word that most accurately describes a lot of fiscal policy that has been enacted, it's not a good thing. But, you know, if any country is going to be able to really pick itself up by the bootstraps, dust itself off, and get back to very productive growth and prosperity, it's the U.S.
Well, Bob, it's been great talking to you. I hope you'll join us again very soon.
Sounds great, Tom. Thanks a lot.
To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.